This week's parsha is Parshas Shmos, Tavshin Ein Ches, and we will begin on page 294. Perek Aleph, Pasuk Tesvav, chapter 1, verse 15. So at this point, the Jewish people have begun being enslaved by the Egyptians. And the Pasuk says, just as the Egyptians afflicted them, that's how much they spread and multiplied. And therefore, Pyro came up with a plan. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, the name of one of them was Shifra, and the second one's name was Pua. Pyro said to them, when you aid the Hebrew women in giving birth, you'll see them on the stone upon which they give birth. In Beinu, if it's a boy, if it's a son, Vamitan, I say, you shall kill him. Vamasi Vachaya, but if it's a girl, you could allow her to live. So, who are these people, Shifra and Pua? So, if you look in Rashi, Shifra and Pua, Rashi says, were Shifra, Zu Yecheved. Shifra was Yecheved, the mother of Moshe. Why was she called Shifra? Al Shemesh Meshaperet Zavlad, because she used to beautify the child, which I think means she used to set the limbs properly so that, you know, its body was in the proper and in the proper shape. So Shifra is Yecheved, Moshe's mother. Pua, Zu Miriam. Pua was Miriam. Because she used to speak to him and used to speak to the child in the way women do to calm a child down. A comforting talk to the child to calm the child down. So Shifra is Yecheved, Pua is Miriam, and each one is being called that name in the Pasuk because of the way that they dealt with the children who they brought into this world. Rabbi Yochanan Lubavitch makes the following point over here. And that is that this is the first time that we meet these women, and they're not called by their regular names. I mean, anywhere else in the Torah that they're going to be mentioned, it's going to be Yecheved, it's going to be Miriam. It's at this point that the Torah does not call them by their regular names, but by their names in this context, in this situation. Now, if the Torah is calling them by this name, then it's not just, some kind of cute nickname that they had. If the Torah calls them by this name, then that is a description of their essence. Because a name is actually, whether we realize it or understand it or not, a name is really the description of the essence of what is carrying that name. And therefore, if these women are being called Shifra and Pua now, then that means that these names define who they are, define their essence. Which means that these women's essence are being defined by how one makes the children look good, and the other one by the fact that she speaks to them in a certain way that calms them down, which doesn't really come across as a very major thing to be have your essence described. What's your essence? You're a babysitter. What's your essence? You just go ahead and you calm down the children by going poo poo poo, whatever it may be. Doesn't seem to be saying much, but clearly if the Torah is calling them by that name, it doesn't mean just to say a nickname or to belittle them, but rather this tells us what their essence is. But that essence seems to be based on something very unimportant, very insignificant, just taking care of little kids. So Rabbi Yochanan Lubavitch says it's possible, or actually the way he says it is great people take little things and make big things out of it. You can be a nurse. You could take care of little children. You could talk to them and play with them and take care of them like women naturally do. But you could actually take that kind of small act and actually turn it into an act that defines you and defines you in a sense of greatness. Meaning, Shifra and Pua, they take care of children. Their essence is to give to children. Their essence is to benefit children. Where does that essence of giving come from? It actually comes from a very small, what seemingly a very small act, an act that any woman would naturally do. But if you take that act, that seemingly small act, and you make it into something big, you could actually become big through it. If you take that small act and you have the proper intent of how and why you're doing it, that actually now can define your greatness. But it doesn't come from doing something heroic or spectacular. It comes from something very seemingly insignificant. But great people take small things and make big things out of it. They can take a small act, a natural act of care that a woman does for caring for a child, but if she does it with the intention of giving and of benefiting others, then that actually becomes her, that becomes the source of her essence of giving and greatness. Because great people make big things out of small things, and as Rabbi Yerucham says, and small people take big things and make little of it and ruin it. And he says, and he gives examples. You know, basically he says anything that would seem to be of either insignificance or even possibly something that could be detrimental. Depending on how you use it and what you make out of it, it could actually be something that's a source of greatness. So he says, for instance, money. Ready? Money is a big problem. Money is the cause of many evils. But at the same time, every day in Shema we say, "V'after Hashem Elokecha, Yishlov Hashem your God." How? With all your soul, with all your heart, with all your soul, uvechal ma'idecha, with all your resources. That thing that seems to be so detrimental and so hazardous to people's spirituality actually is one of the ingredients to be able to fulfill loving Hashem. Because if you take the money and use it in the right way, then you're actually taking something that has a potential for bad and actually bringing out its potential for good. It all depends what you make from it. He talks about marital relations, talks about sexual relations. The Gemara in Kedushin says that from an act like that, you become a partner with Hashem. Become a partner with the Ribbono Shel Olam. And just people look at it as a form of physical gratification. It all depends what you do with it. Great people take even small things. Great people can take things that potentially can be hazardous, and if not used right, but they take it, they use it in the right way, and they bring out their greatness. And they actually create their essence of greatness through those acts. Shifra and Pua took these seemingly small, insignificant, natural acts that any woman would do, but they took that, they used it in the right way, with the right intention, to be givers, to be Balei Chesed, and actually those small acts became their essence to the point that the Torah just calls them by the names that portray these acts. That's because if you take even a small, there's no such thing really as a small act. Every act can be turned to a source of greatness. Depends what you do with it. And that's exactly what Yocheved and Miriam did. They took those small acts, they turned them into great acts, acts of kindness, which then became the definition, and that created their essence of good and giving to the point the Torah calls them by the names that portray these acts, which means these acts are what created their greatness. So that is the point that Rabbi Yerucham brings out in the fact that the Torah calls Yocheved and Miriam Shifra and Pua. Okay. Now, these women received a order from Paro to kill the children. What was the result of that? Pasuk Yud Zayin. Vatirena miyaldes eser leikim. The maidservants feared Hashem, and they did not do as Paro, the king of Egypt, said to them. And they actually, as Rashi says, they kept them alive. Not only did they not kill them, they fed them. The king of Egypt called the midwives and said, "Why do you do this?" And they gave him an excuse. So the midwife said to Paroi, these Hebrew women, they don't wait for the midwives. They give birth before the midwife even arrives. So they get away with it. And it was because the maidservants feared Hashem, that Hashem made them houses. So it's important to focus on the fact that the Torah says, when the Torah says that they did not heed Paro's command, that why didn't they heed his command? They didn't heed his command because, as it says, Vatiarena hamayaldes elikim, the midwives feared Hashem. And when it talks about how Hashem rewarded them, that Hashem gave them houses, the Pasuk says, and it was because the midwives feared God, and God made them houses. This Pasuk Chafalof that we read. The Pasuk there doesn't say that Hashem, that because the Miyaldas did his heroic act and put their lives on the line and saved these children, therefore Hashem made houses for them. But it says because they feared Hashem. Which means that the fearing of Hashem that we're talking about over here has to be seen as the main ingredient, the main thing here. Yeah, clearly it was a heroic act to put their lives on the line not to kill these children. But where did that come from? How did that happen? It only happened because of fear of Hashem. And it's that fear of Hashem that they had that enabled them to do this, and actually because of that, that's where they were rewarded. Now, Rabbi Ruchel Lubavitch points out here something also very interesting, and he says that if we explain this fearing of Hashem as just a reason as to why they didn't do what Paro said, he said you typically don't find the Torah talking about a reason why a person did it. The Torah talks about what the person did. And then, you know, you figure, almost like, you know, then you figure out where it came from, or it's obvious that you say it came from fear of Hashem. But it's not typical for the Torah just to say a cause, a reason for why a person did something. Therefore, he learns when it says, and the maidservants feared Hashem, the Torah is not just telling us the reason, that because they were God-fearing, therefore they didn't listen to Paro. But rather, if the Torah tells us what a person does, then the Torah is telling us that they didn't just have the fear of God, but they were instilling the fear of God in themselves. You know what they had to do here? It's true. What gave them the ability to be strong and not to kill these children and to put their lives on the line for it was fear of God. But as a fear of God that they were instilling into themselves at that point, they had to say to themselves that we can't do this because of the fact that Hashem sees, and Hashem sees what we're doing, and Hashem is going to hold us responsible. Or how can we do such a thing in the presence of Hashem? There was an active instilling in themselves the fear of Hashem. That's what they were doing. If the Torah is describing it, the Torah is telling it to us, that means when the Torah is telling us what they did here in not heeding Paro, step number one of what they did is they instilled fear in themselves. They contemplated fear. They inspired themselves. They aroused the fear within themselves. And they didn't listen. And the next thing was they didn't listen to Paro. And not only that, they went ahead and they fed the children. They kept them alive. But it's an active form. It's an active fear of Hashem. They're actively instilling the fear of Hashem in themselves to make sure that they then heed what Hashem wants. And that's how Rebbe Ruchel explains the mitzvah. We have a mitzvah, Hashem v'lekecha tira, you shall fear Hashem your God. You have a mitzvah to fear. How do you give a person a mitzvah to feel something, to have that to fear? You have it. You're not doing anything. But the answer is, he says, that actually the mitzvah of fearing Hashem means do something. Think about it. Instill it in yourself. That when you find yourself in a situation of a challenge, what do? You think about fear of Hashem. You instill the fear of Hashem in you. It's not just there. The mitzvah is instill it. Put it in yourself. Make it be there. Bring it out within you. And that's what they were doing.
And many people misinterpret the word fear. I think in English language it sounds very negative, but in reality, I think it's something that should uplift you.
It has different levels. Yeah. there's a basic level of fear that says Hashem sees and we better stay in line, or Hashem sees and I'm in the presence of Hashem. Now, that's a very interesting comment that the Berukha makes. But again, as many of the commentaries point out, the Torah is clearly stressing that there was a need for fear of Hashem here. Now, I want to share with you an interesting little piece of history. You know, we know that during World War II, there were a number of non-Jewish diplomats who helped save Jews' lives. There's a famous one in Japan, Sugihara. There was a Chinese one in Austria. And his name was Feng Shenho. And he was the consul general of the Chinese embassy he was head of the Chinese consulate in Vienna. So after Kristallnacht, and the Jews were looking to get out, and nobody wanted to take them, the Jews heard that the Chinese consulate was giving out visas to Shanghai, China. And it was this Feng Shenho that was giving out those visas. And actually his superior from Berlin sent him an order to stop. But he didn't stop. And he wrote, after the annexation of Austria by Germany, the persecution of Jews by Hitler became increasingly fierce, he wrote in his memoirs. The fate of Austrian Jews was tragic. Persecution was a daily occurrence. There were American religious and charitable organizations that were urgently trying to save the Jews. I secretly kept in close contact with them. I spared no effort using my means possible. Many Jews were thus fortunately saved. And he did. It seems that he saved probably around 400 Jews. Eventually, they closed down his consulate. He had to move to a smaller quarter, and he had to pay out of his pocket to run it. In 1940, he left Vienna because there was nothing more to do. And basically, when he retired from being in the Foreign Service for probably over 40 years, the government of Taiwan made some kind of political vendetta against him so that he wouldn't get any kind of a pension when he retired. That's what happened to him for doing this. But clearly he saved a lot of lives. And then he writes in his memoir the following, which is where he answers the question about, you know, why did he do this? And he wrote in his book called 40 Years of Diplomatic Life, I thought it was only natural to feel compassion for the persecuted Jews and to want to help. From the standpoint of humanity, isn't that the way it should be? So this person, this non-Jew, basically felt that a human being should feel compassion for other human beings that are being persecuted for no reason. And he was ready to put himself on the line for it. He put his career on the line. Who knows what else could have been on the line? And at the end, he actually, you know, he lost out. He didn't regret what he did, but he, you know, he lost out. And then the question is, like, what made him different than so many other people who went the complete opposite way? We don't probably have a good answer to that. But you do find individuals, and he and Sugihara and others, you know, basically really put themselves out to save these people. And what did it to them? What did it for them? Now, maybe some were different. Sugihara eventually converted. But this Feng Shenho says it was about humanity. It was about humanity. Now, interestingly, when we talk about Shifra and Pua not killing these children, it doesn't say anything about humanity. It doesn't say anything about morality. It says fear of Hashem. That's what did it for them. And if the Torah is telling us this, the Torah is trying to tell us that in order to be able to withstand this kind of a test, this kind of a challenge, you need to rely on fear of God more than relying on rational thinking or on being humane. Because we know it doesn't work. We know that just looking at history, how once there's an excuse, why to persecute, why to treat a human being like an animal. If you can convince yourself that's the right thing to do, you're going to do it. And Yaakov Kamenetsky points this out in Parashas Noach. In Parashas Noach, when the Torah talks about the prohibition of killing. Let's turn back. Let's look at Parashas Noach. This is going to be Perek Tes Pasuk Vav. Take a look on page 40. Take a look at Pasuk Gimel. Middle of the page. Kol remes asher hu chai. Every moving thing that lives, lochem yeh l'achla, it will be for you for eating. Kierek esiv nasati lochem eskoil, like vegetation, I give you everything. This is where man was permitted now to eat animal. Until then, everybody was a vegetarian. This is the point where man was given permission to eat animal. What's the next thing the Torah teaches us? But flesh with its soul, its blood, you shall not eat. This is referring to the prohibition of Eiver Min Achai. That means you cannot eat a limb from a living animal. So first the Torah says you can eat animals, but you can't basically chop off a limb from a living animal and eat it. What's the next thing it says? However, your blood, which belongs to your souls, I will demand. Of every beast will I demand it, but of man, of every man, for that of his brother, I will demand the soul of man. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. Ki betzelem Elokim asa'as ha'adam, for in the image of God he made man. So what we have here is, the Torah says you can eat animals, you can't eat an Eiver Min Achai, a limb from a living animal, you can't kill each other. Why? Because betzelem Elokim asa'as ha'adam, man was created in the image of God. So if you kill a human being, you are desecrating the image of God. So, if Yaakov Kamenetsky points out, you know, not murdering is something that's universally recognized. It seems to be the most rational, humane thing to understand. And the Torah, when the Torah tells us the prohibition, it has to tell us, you know why not? Because man is created in the image of God. Which means that it's not enough just to rely on this universally accepted, code of morality or form of morality. You can't rely on that because that can be challenged. It doesn't even take much. It can be challenged. If somehow or another you can become convinced, or it convinces you that killing this kind of a person or these kind of people is the right thing to do. It's beneficial for man to do that, and people do it. The whole idea of not killing another human being is because, well, society can't live that way, and, you know, you're a living thing, it's a living thing, why should you take away its life? It seems to be pretty basic. Well, that basic idea can be just thrown out into the garbage if you can be convinced that, no, those humans, they're dangerous. They're bad for mankind. And therefore, at the end of the day, the Torah has to say, you know why you shouldn't kill someone? Because every person is the image of God. And that is what you are desecrating when you kill someone. Meaning at the end of the day, you can't rely on the rationale, on the humanity, on the morals. You've got to rely on your fear of God. You've got to rely on your respect to Hashem. You've got to rely on the spiritual dimension of things, which is the fact that Hashem created this person. He's in the image of Hashem. And therefore, you're going against you're terribly desecrating the honor of God if you kill someone. But it's not. But here you have such a universally accepted idea. Not enough. You have to give a reason. You have to give more of a reason. You've got to give a godly reason, a reason that connects to Hashem. And by just looking at these psukim, what you have here is like this. You have this evolution in the sense that, all right, you could, and this Rabbi Jacob Konevsky points out, all right, I can kill an animal, right? Used to be, if it's a living thing, I couldn't kill it. Couldn't kill it and eat it. Couldn't do it. Well, now I could. Well, if I can kill a living animal, maybe I can just tear off its limb and eat it. No, you can't do that. If I can kill a living animal, maybe I can kill a man. No, you can't do that. That's how we, that's the progression here. What starts from killing an animal, the Torah has to, once the Torah is telling us not to kill an animal, it has to start telling us not to do other things, because one thing can lead to the other thing. A person can think, well, if I can do this, I can do this. And the Torah says, no, you can't do it. And why can't you do it at the end? Why do you have to realize at the end why you can't do it? Because every human being is created in the image of God. Which is how Rabbi Yaakov points out that you have a mitzvah, a clearly understandable mitzvah of not killing, which would be called a mishpat, a mitzvah that we understand, but there's a dimension of chok to it. There's still a mention of a reason that we wouldn't be able to know on our own. Because of the fact that you see here that the Torah had to give us a reason that we wouldn't have known for killing.
Generally, the logical conclusions are very limited.
Right.
And whatever we can do with logic has its very big limitations.
Exactly. So. So that's why from this mitzvah of not killing, you see how there has to be how every mishpat, every rational mitzvah needs a dimension of chok, needs a dimension of a reason that we wouldn't know of on our own. Because as you say, it's a rational reason is limited. There has to be that godly connection to it to make sure to give it a greater chance of being fulfilled under all circumstances. So that's what happened here. What happened here is the fact that the ability for these women to withstand this challenge, the Torah is telling us it wasn't about humanity and it wasn't about morals. That wouldn't have worked here. It happened because of fear of God. And the Torah is teaching it to us for all times that we can't rely. The only thing we can really rely on is going to be our fear and respect of and awe of Hashem. Okay, let's turn back to our Parsha Shmos. Page 296. Perek Beis Pasuk Aleph. Vayelech Ishmi Beis Levi. And a man went from the house of Levi. Vayikach Es Bas Levi. And he took the daughter of Levi. Now we know that the man from the house of Levi is a man named Amram. And the woman that he took for a wife, the daughter of Levi, was Yecheved. Vatara Isha Vatelet Bain, the woman who became pregnant, she gave birth to a boy. Vatera Isai Kitaivu, she saw that he was good, but it's Benoshla Shirachim, she hid him for 3 months. This is the birth of Moshe Rabbeinu. That's what this is, right? So it's very interesting that we are not told the name of Moshe's parents. We eventually know who they are. But here, where seemingly the marriage from which Moshe Rabbeinu was conceived from, no name of who it is. It says a man went from the house of Levi and he took the daughter of Levi. Man took a woman and had a kid. That's how it comes across. So Yaakov Kamenetsky comments on this is that there's a reason why the Torah is keeping it this way, and that is because the Torah is trying to stress that Yiddishkeit, Torah, looks at things differently than the non-Jewish world. Specifically, Christianity, to create its prophet. So how do they say he came about? Immaculate Conception, right? It wasn't a union of a man and a woman. That kind of union couldn't create such a holy person. Couldn't do it. And as Rabbi Yaakov explains, and this again, Rabbi Yaakov writes this in Parshas Bereishis, Basically, he doesn't say Christian world, but basically the Christian world believes that the body and soul really are two distinct things that have nothing to do with each other. The soul exists, this is the way he explains it, the soul exists within the human, but it's like, it has its own completely separate compartment. The two things don't mix. While we in Yiddishkeit believe that there is a very strong integration of the guf of the body, the neshama, and the soul. And because of that integration, the soul is actually able to elevate the body. And therefore, we stress a man married a woman, and from that union came Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu, the prophet, who made everything come about. He was the means that everything came about. He was our greatest prophet. Everything is founded on Moshe Rabbeinu. Our prophet, we have no problem. A man took a woman, and they had a kid. There's nothing contradictory to create it, to having a Moshe Rabbeinu to do that. They don't believe that. To have their spiritual prophet, to have their prophet about that everything is based on, it can't come from man to woman. It can't happen that way. Because that kind of a union isn't holy. There's no holiness in that. And therefore, that can't make such a man. Can't make such a person. And in Parashas Bereishis, when he discusses this, Rabbi Yaakov points this out. He points this out in a very interesting halacha. In the halacha of karbonis, a non-Jew, we know that non-Jews can bring karbonis. But we know there are different types of karbonis that you can offer on your own. You can offer on your own an ola, a burnt offering, where everything's burnt. No one has any benefit from it. There's a karbon shlamim. Karbon shlamim, we know the owner eats from it, the kohen eats from it, and parts of it are burnt. A goy cannot bring a karbon shlamim. He can only bring a karbon ola. An explanation to that is because a goy doesn't have the ability to appreciate or really understand the idea that if I eat from the carbon and the Kohen eats from the carbon, that can bring an atonement to me. That somehow or another, this carbon, this sacrifice, which is meant to bring us so close to God, that part of that process is eating. Eating? Eating meat? That's part of the process of becoming close to God? He can understand an ola, burnt offering. He can understand the idea, I give up everything to God. That he can understand. Because he can understand, but he can only understand basically a sense of ignoring the body, and through that, the soul becomes close to God. While Torah is something that's able to actually, doesn't only make our souls great, make our souls grow. It allows, because our souls and our body are so integrated, and they come together in such a intimate way that actually we can elevate the body. And even what we do with our body can be holy. And that's why he says, there's a famous Gemara in Psachim that talks about how do we celebrate Yontif. According to some, Yontif, we eat, we celebrate. According to others, we sit and learn all day. But the Gemara says, everybody agrees that on Shavuos, you have to have half and half. Half to Hashem, half for yourself. Why? Because Shavuos is the day the Torah was given. Therefore, everybody agrees, it's half to Hashem and half for you. Obviously, the obvious question is, what do you mean? The day the Torah was given, that's the day to be eating? That's the day that everybody should agree, should be learning the whole day. The answer is, it says Rabbi Yankiv, this idea. On Shavuos, the day we're given the Torah, we're trying to bring out this very important idea that we're not that Torah does not divorce us from our physicality, but rather it helps us elevate it and sanctify it. And therefore, the Torah said, didn't say names, right? Didn't say any names. Didn't say names. All it says is, a man took a woman, right? No names or anything. All the Torah wants us to hear here is a man took a woman. And to bring out this idea, that in our, that the Torah is telling us there is no contradicting to making a Moshe Rabbeinu out of a union from a man and a woman, unlike what other religions believe. Okay, now that's one dimension that comes out from the fact that the Torah just says a man took a woman. Again, we know who Moshe Rabbeinu's parents were, and again, their names are left out. So we said, well, we have one explanation or one message that in this is the fact that we're saying, you know, the union of a human man and a human woman, their human act of coming in a union and creating a child is no contradiction to creating a Moshe Rabbeinu. The Shari Ira brings out another idea. And when he asks the question, you know, he tells us who Amram was. Who was Amram? Amram, the Gemara tells us, was one of four people who never sinned. They only died because other Marishan ate from the Eitz Hadas, and a decree was made upon man, they can't live forever. He was one of four people who never sinned. He only died because of the sin of the Eitz Hadas. That was one thing about him. The Gemara in Saita tells us that he was the Gadol Hador, he was the leader of the generation. And the Rambam says that Adam Arisha received six mitzvahs. Noach got a seventh. That's the seven Noachai laws. Shiva mitzvahs b'nei Noach. Abraham received the mitzvah of Mila. And in Egypt, Amram was commanded more mitzvahs until Moshe Rabbeinu came and the entire Torah was completed. I mean, the Rambam says there was a progress. The idea of mitzvahs of being commanded, being obligated to do things, was something that it took place in a progression. Six by Adam, one more by Noach, one more by Adam, by Avraham. I'm sorry, he doesn't say which ones or how many, but more by Amram, and then completed by Moshe Rabbeinu. So who's Amram? Amram was the man who received mitzvahs from Hashem to give to the Jewish people. That's what we're talking about here. And Moshe, his mother was Yocheved. She was a daughter of Levi. You know, it's really odd that we have no mention of who these people are. Now, it's very interesting how the Shari Ira actually brings down a Zohar that deals with this question about why did it just say a man and no names? So basically, the Zohar says is that we know that the Ish going and taking actually is alluding to that which the Gemara in Saita says, that when Pare decreed that all the boys are going to be killed, so Amram left his wife. He left her. He wasn't going to have any more children. And then he came back to her. So the fact that the Medrash doesn't tell us Amram went and took Yocheved, it's all like we don't know who's doing what, is trying to allude that Amram left her quietly, and he took her back quietly. It's like nobody knew. Now, the Shari Arya points out that from the Gemara, that from what the Gemara in Saita says, the Gemara in Saita disagrees. Because, yes, the Gemara in Saita talks about how Amram left his wife and eventually came back. But the Gemara says because Amram was the Gadol Hador, when he left his wife, everybody left their wives. And when he took back his wife, everybody took back their wives. So therefore, according to what our Talmud Bavli seems to be saying, you can't explain that there's no name because it was all a secret, because it wasn't a secret. So he gave one explanation for Rabbi Yankov, and the Shari Ari gives another explanation. And his explanation basically is that by the Torah not saying the names of Moshe Rabbeinu's parents, the Torah is trying to say that Mr. Nobody and Mrs. Nobody can have a Moshe Rabbeinu. You don't have to have an Amram and a Yocheved to be able to have a Moshe Rabbeinu. The Rambam says every person can be a tzaddik like Moshe Rabbeinu. Not a Navi, that we know, nobody can rise to Moshe Rabbeinu as a Navi. But you can be a tzaddik like Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu Vassman explains to mean that just like Moshe Rabbeinu dedicated every aspect of his life to Hashem, everybody can do that. Everybody can do that. So the point of saying no names is because if it said Amar Mar Yecheved, you might think, well, Moshe Rabbeinu was, you know, Moshe Rabbeinu came about. His father was Amram, his mother was Yecheved. That's the way you make a Moshe Rabbeinu. The Torah is trying to say, no, that's not what you need to make a Moshe Rabbeinu. A Moshe Rabbeinu can be made even without Yiches, even without pedigree. Because what makes a difference in who we are is not who our parents are, where we came from, but what we make of ourselves. Now, I would add to this the following. When we talk about coming from your father was a tzaddik and your mother was a tzaddik, we call that yichus, lineage. And lineage is not nothing. There's a pasuk in Mishlei that says, "Mishalech patumay tzaddik," the righteous one walks in his wholeness, in his righteous, in his wholesomeness. Ashrei ben of Achara, fortunate his children after him. The tzaddik walks in his perfection, fortunate are his children after him. So Reb Chaim Lashon explains that to mean a tzaddik works on a trait, he acquires the trait, and he passes it on to his children. The trait, it's easier for his children to attain that trait because of their father's efforts. So clearly lineage is not going to be something that has no effect. But the idea here that Shara is bringing out is based on a famous saying. That saying goes, Yichus, lineage, is like $1 million. Without a one at the beginning, it's a bunch of zeros. You got to have the one at the beginning. You have to do something at the beginning. If you don't do, nothing is going to help you. It's a bunch of zeros after that. What makes the real difference is you. You are the one who makes the difference. And yes, you could have a tzaddik for a father, and he passed on things to you, and it makes it therefore easier for you to do. But at the end of the day, if you don't build on that, and you don't do something with that, and you don't try to get, and you don't try to become greater or try to build yourself up with that, that's not worth anything. It's not worth anything. And that is the lesson here. Another lesson that lies in the fact that Moshe Rabbeinu seems to come from Mr. and Mrs. Anonymous is to bring out that a Moshe Rabbeinu can be born from a Mr. and Mrs. Nobody. They don't have to be anyone special because it's up to us. Our actions are what make us who we are. And without our actions, then we don't get anywhere. That's how the Shaira Oira brings out the lesson here from the fact that there's no names mentioned here. Okay. Oh, one last thing I want to mention about this idea, back to Reb Yankov's idea, that the Torah mentions just man and woman to bring out the idea that that unlike other beliefs, we believe Moshe Rabbeinu came from a man and a woman. So today I was listening to a shiur and Rabbi Eitan Feiner from Far Rockaway. So he said over a very interesting comment from the Ma'aril. The Ma'aril writes that when we refer to Jesus, we refer to him as Yeshu HaNotzri. HaNotzri. So which typically we translate it as from the HaNotzri, the Nazarite. It was from Nazareth. So Notzri is the Hebrew form for Nazareth. Nazareth. Right? That's how you pronounce it. Okay? But that's where he comes from, right? He's called, you know, Yeshu of Nazareth. So the Ma'aril says that he's called Notzri because in the word Notzri is the word Notzar. Nun vav tzadik resh, which means to be formed. Which means, unlike they say he was created, he kind of came out of nowhere, we're saying he's Notzar, he was formed. Formed means that there was something there before, and you're formed from that. It was meant to call him by a name that would bring out the fact that we say no, we don't believe in that. We don't believe in this immaculate stuff. We don't believe that he came out of God. He's a notzar. He was formed. He was formed from things that exist beforehand like everything else. Interesting idea. Okay. Let's now continue on. Again, this is page 296. So Moshe Rabbeinu is put into the Nile, and he is saved by the daughter of Paro. So take a look at Pasuk Zion. It's Perek Beis Pasuk Zayin. Va'atomer achosei el paspare. So Moshe Rabbeinu's sister Miriam, who had been standing and watching what's going on, she goes over to the daughter of Paro and she says, Ha'eilech, shall I go? V'karasi lach isha menekes, and call for you a wet nurse, mina ivrius, from the Hebrew women. Should I go get a Jewish nurse for the baby? V'seinik lach asayolin, and she will nurse the child for you. Why did Miriam go over to the door of Paro and offer her a Jewish nurse? So Rashi says, because they tried giving Moshe Rabbeinu to the Egyptian wet nurses and he wouldn't nurse from them. Why wouldn't he nurse from them? So Rashi brings down, Melamed shechsiras la mitzriyeis har belionik, that she took the baby to nurse to many Egyptian women's, but he wouldn't nurse. Why? Vayishamayim was going to speak with the Shechina. A mouth that was going to speak with the Shechina isn't going to nurse Gayisha milk. That's what it says. Now, this is actually has halachic ramifications. And if Yaakov Kronetsky brings this down and makes the following comment about it. Okay. So in Shulchan Aruch Yerideya, it's brought down in the Ramah. Chalav Mitzris, the milk of an Egyptian woman, which means a non-Jewish woman. Kachalav Yisraelis is like the milk of a Jewish woman. It's kosher. Just because coming from a non-Jewish woman, that means not kosher. It's kosher. Umikamakam, nonetheless, lo yaniko tinek mena mitzris. A child should not nurse from an Egyptian, from a non-Jew. Im efshar b'Yisraelis, if it's possible to find a Jewish wet nurse. The chalav avedas kachavim, because the milk of a non-Jew metamtem alev umay the tevera. It stuffs up the heart and creates a bad nature. Which is an idea that we find by non-kosher food. Non-kosher food has this concept of timtum alev. It's something that blocks up the heart. It has a spiritual damage to you. Spiritual damage is your neshama. So even though this the milk of the non-Jewish woman, we say it's kosher, it's not treif, but it still has that aspect of this negative effect, this negative spiritual effect. The Vilna Gaon writes, where do we get this idea from? Where does it come from? The Vilna Gaon, in the name of the Rashba, says the source for this is Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu refused to nurse from the Egyptian women because he was going to speak with the Shechina. So that's the source to say that you should not nurse from a non-Jewish woman. So Yaakov asks, how can we learn from Moshe Rabbeinu to everybody else? The reason given is because Moshe Rabbeinu was going to speak with the Shechina. That's why he couldn't nurse from a non-Jewish woman. But isn't that's unique to Moshe Rabbeinu? How does it become a source to say for all Jewish children that they shouldn't nurse from a non-Jewish woman? So Rabbi Yankov says, we see from here something very important, that we have to look at every baby, that this baby has the potential to speak with the Shechina. We have to look at every single baby, that every single baby has that purity that potentially they could speak with the Shechina. And therefore, we don't want to mess that up. Starting, even a little baby, we don't want to mess that up. And therefore, you can't say her milk is not treif, but he shouldn't nurse from a non-Jewish woman. It's going to affect him. Just like when Moshe Rabbeinu wouldn't drink from that milk because it would affect him. Every Jewish child is like Moshe Rabbeinu in the sense that it has that purity and potential to speak with the Shechina. And that's how we have to look at our children as we raise them. Each one of them has that strong potential. If it has that strong potential, we have to protect it. But that's a fascinating idea. The idea that we can learn from Moshe Rabbeinu not nursing from the Egyptian women because of the fact that he would speak to the Shechina means to say, and we're learning that now for all Jewish children, that all Jewish children have the potential. all those children have that very, very special sanctity that for the same reason Moshe Rabbeinu wouldn't nurse from a non-Jewish woman, we should not allow our children to nurse from non-Jewish people. Okay. Now, the last thing for tonight. We're going to turn to page 300. And at this point, Moshe Rabbeinu has grown up. He had to run away from Egypt. Let's take a look at Pasuk Beis. Page 300, Perek Gimel, Pasuk Beis. Vayera malach Hashem elo babas esh b'tei chasne. The angel of Hashem appeared to him in a flame of fire from the midst of the bush. Vayar and he saw, v'nei hasne b'yar b'esh, behold, the bush was burning in fire. Vasne ninu ukol, but the bush is not being consumed. Vayerim Moshe, so Moshe said, Asurana. Moshe said, I will turn aside now, the ere, and I will see, as Amara Gadalazeh, this great vision. Madul Yivar Asne, why doesn't the bush burn? Vayar Hashem Kisar L'Rois, Hashem saw that he was turning aside to see. Vayikrelev Elohim Itay Chasnet, Hashem called him from the midst of the bush. Vayir Moshe Moshe, he said, Moshe Moshe, Vayir Neni, he said, here I am. So, Moshe Rabbeinu, basically if he says, I will turn and see this wondrous thing, why isn't the bush burning, being consumed, even though it's on fire, it means Moshe noticed something, but he was now going to turn. He was now going to take a closer look somehow. And the Alkot Shemayini brings down. The following. Rabbi Yechonon Amar Gimel Psias Pasa Moshe. When Moshe Rabbeinu said, "I will turn to see," what did he have to do exactly? What did he have to do to see more? To get more of it, to see more of what was going on. Rabbi Yechonon says he took three steps. It took him three steps before Hashem said to him, before Hashem began speaking to him. Resh Lakish Amar, Resh Lakish says, Loi Pasa, he didn't take any steps. Elat Savari Okam, he turned his head. He craned his neck to see. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, Nitzta'arta Lirois, you. And it's the arta, you put in this painful, and it's the arta, you pain yourself to see, you put in some suffering to see, great effort to see. Chayecha, I swear, sha'agala elecha, that I will reveal myself to you. And that's when it says, Hashem saw that he had turned to see, and Hashem called to him from the bush. So the Yalkut is, the Medrash brought down on the Yalkut, is telling us that Moshe Rabbeinu said, you know, I'm going to go take a look. And he turned to take a look. He didn't take much to have to turn to go and see. That by the time he just either took three steps or turned around, Hashem revealed himself to him. Or Hashem said, I swear I'm going to reveal myself to you. Somehow or another, what Moshe Rabbeinu did here was something that gave him now the merit that Hashem should appear to him. So what's exactly happening here? I mean, it's the arta, you suffered, you pain yourself to see. I mean, he saw something really interesting, and all he did was take a few steps or turn around to see. And Hashem says, I swear I'm going to reveal myself to you. What's exactly happening here? What's the big fuss here? So I thought that perhaps what it meant is that, you know, it doesn't seem like such a big fuss, right? But again, you know, to take three steps to go forward to see what's going on is a certain amount of effort. To crane your neck is a certain amount of effort. We know from Pirkei Avos, from Sarah Agra, the greater your effort, the more your reward. Hashem takes effort into account. And it would seem like Hashem said to Moshe, you took this effort, now I'm revealing myself to you. Now you're the man. Was it a lot of effort? Maybe not. But it was effort. And it was that effort that basically clinched it for Moshe. Which means that there's a certain degree of what Moshe has to do to merit something. At the end of the day, what did it take him at the end to clinch it, to finally merit it? Nothing major. Some effort. But every effort, every amount of effort counts. And every amount of effort can make the difference. And that can be what the Torah is trying to tell us here by Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu, there is now going to be, he's going to now become the prophet of Hashem. Everything that we have, this was the beginning of everything that we have. And you know what it took? It took a little effort. Took a little effort on his part, and that's what clinched it. And therefore, a person should never let any efforts go. Grab every opportunity to make the effort for something, no matter what that effort may be, because you never know, that effort could be what's going to finally, basically, push him over and clinch it for him. Rabbi Mordechai Kamenetsky says a different explanation, perhaps a better one, because the word explained to the word nitzta'arta. And that is, he wants to learn that when Moshe Rabbeinu first, you know, Moshe Rabbeinu said, I'm going to turn to see what's going on. The means Moshe Rabbeinu noticed something, right? He noticed this burning bush and it's not being consumed. Now he's going to take another look. But he saw something, he noticed something, now he's going to take another look. From the word nitzta'arta, which means you suffered for this, it means to say that Hashem recognized that Moshe Rabbeinu realized that if I go now, if I turn to see what's going on, this is going to change my life. Meaning, if Moshe Rabbeinu realized that when he saw this burning bush, he already knew there's something happening here. There's a potential here. So now, is he going to go closer? Is he going to go take a look? Is he going to figure out what's going on? Is he going to basically now make the move that's going to make a tremendous difference in his life? Or is he just going to move on? And that wasn't an easy decision to make. The Rebbeinu Shalom recognized nitzta'arta, that when he made that move, it took a lot to do, because it wasn't an easy thing to do. And that's what clinched it for Moshe Rabbeinu. What clinched it for Moshe Rabbeinu to become that prophet, to become that Navi Hashem, what did it need? It needed him to make that decision, to be willing to make that difficult decision to take the responsibility that was going to lie in this. And even though there wasn't a big act involved, right? That's what the Medrash seems to be stressing. He turned his neck, he took a few steps. There wasn't a lot of effort and action involved. But Rabbi Shalom looked deeper. Rabbi Shalom knew what was going on inside of him. So the point, according to this, would be in the Medrash is to say that even without a lot of action, a lot of physical effort, right? Even without, no, you don't need any kind of heroic act. But what clinched for Moshe Rabbeinu was his willingness to take on the responsibility. Basically, not to pass on the responsibility, but to be willing that to take it on. Willing to take the responsibility. Because Moshe Rabbeinu realized here, there's something big going on here. This is going to make a big difference in my life. And it wasn't easy to turn, because he knew that was going to be it. This was going to be it. But he was willing to do it. And even though it didn't take much effort involved in it, it wasn't much for him to do, but the main point was, is that there was nitzta'arta. It's the point is, it wasn't an easy thing. It wasn't an easy thing for you to do. I realize it wasn't an easy thing for you to do. And because it wasn't easy and you did it anyway, you took the responsibility anyway, that is now why Hashem says, I swear I will reveal myself to you. Have a good night.
Thank you.